It's a terrifying thing to have to make big decisions, isn't it? I guess that's why we are prepared to pay executives and company managers and the like such high salaries. As most of us find the cartoon stereotype of the senior executive all too lifelike for comfort. You know, the office carpet worn thin from anxious pacing, the desktop scored with scratches where tense hands have clenched and pounded with feverish uncertainty, the private drawer crammed with sedatives, maybe, the head swathed in wet towels even. It's not for us, is it? Decision-making is a stress-ridden occupation, and we would rather avoid it altogether. We prefer to have jobs, perhaps, where we can pass the responsibility to others higher up the line. In fact, there's a story told about Pope John the 23rd, who confessed on one occasion, "I often half wake up at night and begin to think about a serious problem and decide I must tell the Pope about it. Then I wake up completely and remember I am the Pope." A rather similar story from Harry S. Truman, who had, according to legend, on his desk a little plaque which read, "The buck stops here." Now, of course, we're all not all presidents, are we? We don't all have to decide for nations. And we're not all popes. We don't all have to decide for churches. We're not all managers. We don't have to decide for companies. But even though we may not occupy high-flying jobs like that, we can't avoid personal responsibility entirely, can we? Because we're all individuals. However small our sphere of responsibility in this world, it exists. And in a limited sense, it's true for each of us, therefore. The buck stops here. There are some decisions all of us have to take for ourselves. Take marriage, for instance. That's a big one, isn't it? The minister stands in front of us and says, "Wilt thou have this woman?" It's a second person singular inquiry. Wilt thou? No one can take that decision from us. The buck stops right there. Whether our reply is the "I will" of determined resolution or stupefied amazement, the responsibility is ours. Same goes for career. That's another big decision, isn't it, that we take for ourselves. And one of the biggest and one of the more problematical ones, perhaps, for many of us, because we're confronted in the 20th century with such a vast array of possible avenues of life, even in a depressed economy like ours. Many of us have a great variety of choices we could make as far as career goes. There simply isn't time to do everything we might like to do or that we might even feel worthwhile to do. Because we've only got one life to invest on the wheel of fortune. We can't afford to fritter it away, can we, by backing every number. If we're going to do anything with our lives, then there comes a time when we have to be prepared to decide, right, this is it, this is what I'm going to do. I think one of the reasons there are so many bored and disillusioned people in our world today is that many don't feel capable of making that big decision. They can't fix on some single goal to integrate their life round. And so they wander in a fog of dissatisfaction for all too many years, trying this and trying that, but never really getting anywhere. I've met a few people like that. We really do need to know where we're going in our lives, don't we? We're not like animals content just to survive. Every suicide is saying he needs something to live for. But we never can discover that purpose by running away from decisions. Human self-determination is our dignity, but also our curse, perhaps. There's no way we can abdicate responsibility for our lives, whether we be presidents or popes or managing directors or just ordinary run-of-the-mill human beings. To be a human being is to make decisions. And that's why it's such a terrifying thing to be a human being sometimes. How do we choose? With so much advice being offered to us, so many pressures on us, so many opportunities may be open to us, how do we make decisions? It's an encouragement to me personally that even Jesus sometimes had to go through agonizing crises when he had big decisions to take. Son of God though he was, he had the power of choice too, free choice. He had a will, and he had to choose what he was going to do with that self-determination. And it wasn't always easy. Take this great text, for instance, that's the subject of our short Bible study tonight. "Father, if you are willing," he says, "take this cup from me, Yet not my will, but yours be done. I suppose there must be many millions of prayers that have been prayed in the course of history, but I doubt if there has ever been any prayer quite so agonized as that one. Offered, you see, in a moment of crisis, a moment of decision, a life at the crossroads. Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me. Yet not my will, but yours be done. I want to suggest to you, first of all, there are some important things we learn about prayer itself from that verse. One thing, for instance, we learn is that prayer is costly. Many of us, I think, have a sort of stereotype of prayer that we perhaps get down on our knees or otherwise, but we really run through a trite recital of formulae, rather infantile formulae sometimes, Lord bless this and Lord bless that. Perhaps we say the Lord's Prayer. I wonder if our prayers have ever made us sweat. This prayer did. It was costly, it was demanding, it was an effort. Real prayer should be like that sometimes, you know. Because real prayer is the battleground between my will and God's. It's the place where big decisions are made. Prayer. Something else I think we learn about prayer from this is that it ought to be extraordinarily honest. Couldn't be much more honest than Jesus is being here, could you? God, I don't want to go this way. The way I'm going at the moment is not the way I really want to go. If it's possible, take this cup from me, he said. Again, I suspect that many of us, you know, when we start to pray, really feel we have to say platitudes. We have to say the things we think God wants us to say, the things he'd like to hear. We're not really honest, we're pretentious. Real prayer speaks its mind. Real prayer is candid. Real prayer isn't running away from the things I really feel, from the conflicts I'm experiencing. If real prayer is a flight like that, an escape like that, it can't possibly do us any good. Real prayer has to be ruthlessly honest with what I'm really feeling about this situation. It has to admit just how much I hate it, just how much, if you like, I'm rebelling against it even. Prayer is the place where it is right to confess those feelings. But perhaps the most important lesson we learn about prayer from this is that sometimes prayers are denied. There are folk, of course, who will tell you that prayers are always answered, and they're always answered yes, and that we should never accept the answer no. It's a lack of faith to do so. Well, I think Jesus sets the record right on that score, doesn't he? If it be possible, he said, if you're willing, take this cup from me. Yet not my will, but yours be done. See, that's the thing about prayer. It isn't magic. Some people think it is. Some people think that just like the magician lays hold of supernatural powers by conjuring some magic spell, so prayer is a kind of way of manipulating the supernatural to do what we want. In fact, you sometimes get the idea from people, very much like the occult, that the efficiency of prayer depends a lot on how much you get worked up when you're saying it or using the right formula of words. It's all a load of nonsense, isn't it? Prayer isn't a way of getting my will done. Prayer is a way of getting God's will done. Prayer has always got that condition in it. Father, if you are willing, if it hasn't got that condition in it, either explicitly or implicitly, then it isn't prayer at all. It's an attempt at magic. And the Bible doesn't believe in magic. Now, prayer is an act of submission. Prayer is always an inquiry, never a demand. Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me. Yet not my will, but yours be done. We learn something about prayer then, something very important, that it is costly, that it has to be ruthlessly honest, and most of all, that it can be denied. Because prayer is always conditional on God's will, not just our own. We learn something secondly about the cross from that text, you know. The cross where Jesus died. Two very interesting things about it, I think. We learn, first of all, that the cross was planned. There's a clear implication of Jesus' words, isn't it? If you're willing, take this cup from me, yet not my will, but yours be done. Since the cross happened, it follows that it must have been God's will. Haven't you ever wondered why Jesus died on the cross? If ever a tragedy needed an explanation, that one did. After all, he didn't have to go up to Jerusalem, did he? He knew it was dangerous. But he insisted on going. He didn't have to choose Judas. He knew right from the beginning he was a traitor, and yet he made him one of the inner circle and let him in on all his secret plans. He didn't have to expose himself to easy capture in the Garden of Gethsemane, yet we read tonight how he set himself up for it. He didn't have to remain silent before the governor, Pilate. He could have spoken out in his own defense, but he didn't. Most of all, he didn't have to stay on that cross. Save yourself, they jeered. Come down from the cross, then we'll believe in you. He saved others, himself he cannot save. And why didn't he do just that? If he was the Son of God, as the Bible makes out, as Christians say, why didn't he come down? This man had healed the pain of others. Why was he now enduring such incomparable pain and finding no relief? If ever a tragedy needed an explanation, that one does. And there it is. Paradoxical though it be, it was God's will. Something was being accomplished on that cross. It wasn't just a meaningless accident. It wasn't just a fortuitous chain of events. God planned it and achieved something through it. It was his will. That's the first thing we learn about the cross from that text. But there's something else we learn about the cross too, don't we? Jesus was repelled by it. If it be possible, he says, if you're willing, take this cup from me. You see him there praying, and he sees what's about to happen to him as if it was a vessel that he had to drink. And he's repelled by the contents of that cup. What was it that repelled him so violently? Was it death? He knew death was in that cup. Was that what repelled him? Well, of course, death repels us all, doesn't it? Nobody wants to die. And yet, Jesus knew death wasn't the end, didn't he? He taught his disciples so. He'd even just raised a man called Lazarus from the dead, according to the gospel. He told his disciples he would die and after 3 days rise again. He knew death wasn't the end. And it's because Christians down through the ages have known that death wasn't the end that many of them have gone to their death singing hymns. So why couldn't Jesus sing a hymn in the Garden of Gethsemane and look forward to it? Or was it perhaps the pain that was involved? Is that what repelled him? Is that what he saw in the cup? For of course, crucifixion is a most appallingly tortuous death. We get the word excruciating from it, don't we? It is terribly painful. Is that the source of his repugnance, that he couldn't bear the thought of that physical torture? Well, I suppose that might have been part of it, but again, you know, there have been many Christians down through the ages who've suffered physical torture just as excruciating. Some have been martyred by burning, by being torn apart by animals in the arena, by all kinds of vicious techniques devised by the fiendish imagination of men. And those Christians have borne that suffering and the prospect of it with a much better heart than Jesus seems to have done. Were they better Christians than Jesus then? What was it that he saw when he looked in that cup that repelled him? Well, I'll tell you. What he saw in that cup was sin. our sin. The moral failure that lies on our consciences, every one of us, one way or another, he saw it all in that cup. Because you see, when he hung on the cross, he died a death no Christian ever dies. A death to sin. A death as one who in God's eyes is guilty of the foulest and most defiling of evils. I had a girl this week ask me if I'd ever known what it felt like to be dirty. Because that's how she felt, just as we were talking. Well, Jesus knew that feeling. All the more acute for him when you realize he had never felt dirty before. All his life, he had lived in perfect, holy communion with God. He'd never known what it was to have a guilty conscience. He'd never known what it was to pray, "Forgive my sins." He was pure. But in that cup, he saw sin. And that's what repelled him. Sin that he would have to bear and identify with and suffer for. Our sin. And that brings me to the third area that we learn about from this verse, I think. We learn about prayer. We learn something about the cross. We learn, thirdly, something about the meaning of obedience. Remember we said at the beginning, we all have a power of choice. And we all have to decide how we're going to use that power of choice. Ultimately, you know, though there may be a variety of things we can do with our lives, the ultimate choice is really only twofold. We can either decide to do what we want, or we can decide to do what God wants. That's the ultimate choice that faces us. That was the ultimate choice that faced Jesus. Though he was the Son of God, he had a will of his own, you see. He could distinguish it from his Father's will. "My will," he says. He was a human being, just like you and me. He had a power of choice. He could do what he wanted or what his Father wanted. Just like Adam, perhaps, who thousands of years before had faced the same dilemma. Only, of course, Adam had decided to do what he wanted. That was the root of the problem. But Jesus prayed, "Father, not my will, but yours be done." That same choice confronts us tonight, you know. The devil is quite happy to see us here in church. He doesn't really mind if we read our Bibles a bit now and again, even pray. He's quite happy for us to put a bit of money in the offering, even sing a few hymns. The devil isn't all that bothered by that kind of religion. What throws the powers of darkness into unholy terror is to see a man or a woman like Jesus saying to God, "Father, not my will, but yours be done." That's really what it's all about. That's what a Christian is. A Christian isn't a person who goes to church every Sunday. Lots of people do that. A Christian isn't a person who loves his neighbor. Lots of people try to do that anyway. A Christian is a person who has consciously submitted their wills to God's will. But when it comes to this ultimate and final decision we all have to make, what am I going to do with my power of choice? Has said like Jesus, "Not my will, but yours be done." The way to discover what it means to be a human being as God really originally made us is not to say, my will be done. It's to say, thy will be done. And tonight, the choice is ours. Let's pray together.